Venerable Chodron is traveling in Europe. She's on a five-week teaching tour. I think she was in Denmark this week, and tonight she should be in Germany. So we'll continue with our investigation of established bases, basic ontology. So let's start by developing our motivation for tonight. As Venerable often reminds us, we are completely interdependent with other living beings. And as a result, we're greatly affected and also benefited by their actions. We've received an incredible amount of kindness from other beings. And without the kindness of others, without the efforts they've made and all the things that they do, we wouldn't even be here. We couldn't sustain our existence and we wouldn't be able to practice the Dharma. So we can think about all the resources we've needed to stay alive in this life, all the food we've eaten, the clothes and shoes we've worn, all the various buildings we've made use of, all the roads we've driven on, all the books we've read, all the friends and teachers who've influenced us. The fact is, everything we use, contact, and benefit from is due to the efforts and thus the kindness of others. The fact that we can study this text on Buddhist reasoning and debate is due to the kindness of countless beings. First of all, Shakyamuni Buddha, his great kindness in turning the wheel of Dharma during this fortunate era, and all the scholars and practitioners who preserved the Buddhist tradition over the centuries, Dignaga and Dharmakirti, and all those who developed this Buddhist system of reasoning and logic and debate. The incredible kindness of Dan Perdue for writing this text in English so that we can understand it. And of course, Venerable's kindness in introducing this text to us. And all the Abbey benefactors who make it possible for these classes to take place and be broadcast over the internet. And so when we think about this deeply, it gives us some sense of being the recipient of tremendous kindness from others. And so we can use that awareness to generate a sincere wish to repay all that kindness by developing our wisdom and compassion, and specifically through engaging with our studies tonight on Buddhist reasoning and debate, so that we can be of greater and greater benefit to all these kind beings. This week I send out a link to the residents here at the Abbey for a text called Debate Primer. Well, it's Debate Primer Text 1, Fundamentals of Debate, Collected Topics. And it was put together by Ngarampa Sangye Sultram and also Venerable Tenzin Tarpa. He's an American, the last one is the American monk at Sarah J. Monastery. And so Venerable Chuni brought a couple of hard copies back for us, and also the text is available online. You can find it at tibet2009.com, and I think it's worthwhile as a resource to download it and have a look. It can help us in our understanding of reasoning and debate. And I just wanted to read a couple of excerpts from page 6. He begins by saying, "How does learning debate benefit us? The dialectic method of debate creates a clarity and precision of mind that's useful in every facet of life. Debate improves concentration and memory. It teaches us how to put forth a viewpoint and defend against false assumptions. Most importantly, it teaches us how to properly use reason in order to think more efficiently and effectively, helping us to make better decisions, leading to better lives. Debating Buddhist philosophy, which includes the study of reasoning and the mind, is a powerful tool in shaping our consciousness. Reason allows us to transcend our habitual and sometimes uncontrollable emotions. In debate, we see for ourselves how reasoning can be used to effectively manage emotions." Then there's this long quote from Thupten Jinpa, His Holiness, one of His Holiness's translators, and I thought he makes a good point here. He says, "In the beginning, debate has a rigid format with set formulas and fixed answers, the study and memorization of which can be quite challenging. But once you have gained a mastery over the path of reasoning, you move beyond these set formulas, after which spontaneity and fluidity begin to arise. This is the place where real debate arises and where true wisdom is found. So tonight we'll begin experimenting with some very basic debate formulas as a way of helping us to learn the material that we're looking at now, principally the definitions of the things that are mutually seven definiendums that are mutually inclusive with existence. But before we get to that, I'll just ask, does anyone have any syllogisms they want to test out? Okay, moving right along. All right, then we'll proceed with the text. We left off on page 144, or for ebook users, we're in the section now. It's just under the definition of an existent, but I think it's worthwhile going back and taking a second look at that section, the definition of an existent. There's a lot of information there that we need to understand. So as we see here in the text, the definition of an existence is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. And we'll do some of the debating that we've been practicing a little bit later. But notice it says a reliable cognizer is a certifying consciousness. Because right there in the definition, we see that it's that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. That's Venerable Chodron's preferred translation of that word, reliable cognizer instead of valid cognizer. Okay, so a reliable cognizer is a certifying consciousness. What we'll find when we study awareness and knowers, or LORIG, and some of you have studied that, I know, is that the definition of a reliable cognizer, at least in the Sutra School, presentation of tenets, a reliable cognizer is a new, incontrovertible knower. So new being the first moment of either, there are two types, two main divisions of reliable cognizers. Maybe this is helpful because you've heard these terms before. So if we looked at the two main divisions of reliable cognizers, there are direct perceivers, or more precisely, we could say direct reliable cognizers. So direct in that term is referring to consciousness that incontrovertibly gets at its object without the use of a generic image. In other words, it's not conceptual. It's a non-conceptual mind, at least for the Sutra School. That's one type, a direct reliable cognizer, and an inferential reliable cognizer, sometimes just called an inference or sometimes an inferential cognition. So an inferential reliable cognizer is still an incontrovertible, a new incontrovertible knower, but it's realizing its object through the medium of a generic image. It's a conceptual mind, but it's still a very strong mind. So if we understand something about these minds that we're trying to develop in our mind stream, that will help us understand a little bit more about existence and how they're known. Okay, so new means it's the first moment of either an inferential reliable cognizer or a direct reliable cognizer. The first moment. The second moment is no longer new. It's no longer a reliable cognizer. Now it's a subsequent cognizer. So from the Sutra School point of view, there are only two types of reliable cognizers. A subsequent cognizer, the second moment in that same continuum of either inference or direct perception, is also incontrovertible. It's still a very strong mind. We'll want to develop those, but it's not the first moment, so it's just distinguished in that way. Incontrovertible. It means that the knower, the cognizer, has eliminated any superimposition with regard to its object. So it's getting at its object in a very clear and reliable way. So incontrovertible, I mean it's indisputable, it's incontestable, it's undeniable, it's irrefutable. All these synonyms for that word are very powerful words. It's unassailable, unquestionable. It's the kind of minds we want with our Dharma experiences. And then knower is just referring to a consciousness. So there are three terms that are synonymous, and they're all referring to the same meaning, and that is a consciousness, a knower, and an awareness. When we talk in philosophical terms, those three terms are mutually inclusive and synonymous. Evidently, there were some Buddhist schools or some practitioners who asserted that a reliable cognizer could be a sense power, a sense faculty. I think it was a great exposition school. So this is to refute that. All right, so a new incontrovertible knower, a NIC, N-I-C, N-I-K, sorry. That's how I remember it. Okay, so just to go through that paragraph again. A reliable cognizer is a certifying consciousness. Whatever it observes must exist. Okay, so this is in line with the principle that you cannot know that which does not exist. This seems rather circular on the face. An existent is what is observed by a valid cognizer, and a valid cognizer observes existence. In this system of thought, they hold that a valid cognizer cannot be wrong in regard to the object it understands. Even though it does seem rather circular, it does not bother Dan Perdue as much as it used to. It seems that the point is to affirm the certainty of knowledge as opposed to mere belief, and in this meditative tradition, to affirm the priority of consciousness rather than the outer world. So there's an emphasis placed on the consciousness knowing the object rather than what we see in the consequent school, which is there's equal weight given to the object and the consciousness, right? Because, an object can be known, well, let's see, how do I say this? In some of the schools, there's a particular mind called a self-cognizer. You remember that term? You see, for something to exist, there has to be a certifying mind, a mind that certifies that it exists. So in some schools, like the Sutra School, they say you have to have a self-cognizer to affirm that there is a consciousness. In the consequent school, they say, no, that's actually not necessary. Just the mere fact that a consciousness knows an object certifies the consciousness knowing that object, and vice versa. An object exists because there's a consciousness that knows it. So those things have equal weight. So that's something that comes up in tenets. Okay, so now we're moving into some new material, the phenomena mutually inclusive with existence. So here we find a list of seven terms, categories that are mutually inclusive with existence. So it says, initially it is helpful to understand the eight names given to existence and the characteristics noted for each of these. There are other names too, but these are the primary. These are primary. As already mentioned, existence are also called established bases. The definition of an established base is that which is established by a reliable cognizer. So I have suggested to some of you to write out these eight definitions because that helps you to be able to see right away. Here in the text, it's all spread out. But if we make a list of them, then we can start seeing some of the similarities and it makes it easier to memorize the definitions. Okay, so an established base is that which is established by a reliable cognizer. So that's very similar to the definition for existent, isn't it? There we were saying that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Here it's that which is established by a reliable cognizer. This means that every existent is an established base, a basis the existence of which is certified by a valid cognizer. This is in line with the definition of an existent as that which is observed by a valid cognizer. Also, very closely in line with the characterizations of an existent and an established base is that everything is an object of comprehension, defined as that which is realized by a reliable cognizer. Okay, so just to look at those definitions, we can see the similarities. It's going to be easier to hold those in mind. So thus, in three ways, all existent things are characterized as those things that are established, observed, and realized by reliable cognizers. That is, Buddhists are emphasizing the issue of what is a reliable consciousness and affirming that what those consciousnesses understand must be existent bases of reality. So this goes back to what Dan Perdue said in an earlier chapter that, it's our epistemology that should inform our ontology, not the other way around. In other words, knowing the methodology of how things exist before proving that those things exist.
Just want to make sure I got this word right. Back just a little bit, when you were talking about incontrovertible, that means there's no superimposition with regard to the object. Was that the word, superimposition?
Yes. Okay. That's from Dan Perdue's debate.
Thank you.
Do we get into the definitions of observed versus established versus realized at some point? Does that come later?
Well, realized, I can speak to that. And that means to correctly and incontrovertibly know. So realize, we use that word very casually, don't we? Oh, I realize this and that. But actually, from a philosophical point of view, that when we use that word realize or ascertain, a synonym, we're actually talking about having an incontrovertible knower that knows that object. So it would be either a direct perception or an inferential cognition or a subsequent cognition that knows that object. So we're talking about very specific minds that are actually engaging with that object. I haven't heard anything about observed. You can only observe something that exists. Establish. How are things established? Again, from the Sutra School point of view, I think you could say that an object is established. In other words, it sort of it is proven or... I can only guess at that, that it's established, it's proven, it comes into being because there's a consciousness that knows it. And there's a whole separate debate and discussion about that. Actually, Venerable talked about that the last teaching that she gave. So, don't know if that helps, but maybe it'll come up a little bit. Actually, he does talk a little bit more about that on the next page. Okay, so along the same lines, everything that exists is an object defined as that which is known by an awareness. Okay, so that definition brings in something a little bit different. That which is known by an awareness. So what we'll see is that for something to be known, it must exist. We can't know something that doesn't exist. That doesn't mean that we can't engage non-existence with our mind. We can develop a generic image of something that doesn't exist. In fact, we do all day long. Inherently existent computer, inherently existent person, inherently existent love and anger and all the rest. Also, in that definition, an awareness, it's not just talking about any awareness. It's talking about a reliable cognizer. So this will be explained a little bit lower. Okay. So I'm in my text, I think it's helpful in if you have your own book to somehow distinguish these definiendums and their definitions so that they stand out to your mind, so that you can see them. Otherwise, this is just a jumble of words. And even put a little number out to the side of each of the 8 definiendums so that you can find them easily. Okay. Also, everything that exists is an object of knowledge, defined as that which is suitable as an object of an awareness. In this epistemology, awareness goes along with knower and consciousness. Those three terms are synonymous. If something is one of these, then it must be the others as well. An awareness is not the same as a reliable cognizer, which is a correct certifying consciousness. Rather, an awareness is any sort of consciousness, right or wrong, reliable or not. However, the bit in the definition of an object as known by an awareness limits the type of awareness that might know an existent to those that are correct and reliable. If we were to look at the large category of consciousness, then we could divide that in 2 different ways. Usually we talk about it in terms of main minds and mental factors. So main minds, knowing the bare entity of the object, and the mental factors are those things that know more of the features, the qualities of the object. Another way to divide consciousness is in terms of reliable cognizers and non-reliable cognizers. So, for instance, in the explanation of the 7 main types of awareness for developing realizations, then under reliable cognizers, we'd have the 2 that we just mentioned, direct perceivers and inferential cognizers. And then on the other side, we'd have the other five. Maybe you remember those. So subsequent cognizer, that's not reliable. It's not a new incontrovertible knower, so it's a second moment. Therefore, it doesn't really fit the definition of new incontrovertible knower. Correct assumption is another type of awareness that can be factually concordant or factually valid. Valid, would you use that word? Factually correct, let's say. But it's not incontrovertible. If we had a conversation with somebody and we started debating and perhaps they had a good line of logic, they could talk us out of our position. This is the beauty of developing incontrovertible knowers, these reliable cognizers, because at least in our own mind, it may not be a reliable cognizer for everyone, but we're trying to develop these strong minds in our own continuum so that we can hold our position on what we know for ourselves and our own meditations, and also so that when we're discussing others and trying to help others further their understanding, then we have a very strong basis to come from. So correct assumptions are nice. We probably all have a lot of correct assumptions, like the self lacks inherent existence. I bet we have a correct assumption about that, but probably it's controvertible at this point. If we heard a really good line of logic, we might have doubt. You know, we might be swayed from our position. So there's correct assumptions. There's also doubt. That's a non-reliable consciousness, and also wrong consciousness is a non-reliable consciousness. There's also something called an awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained. So that rings a bell for some of you who've done that study. And it's coming up in our text. So we'll have a chance. So we're just planting a few seeds here right now. Similarly, in the definition of object of knowledge, the bit that specifies that an object of knowledge is suitable as an object limits them to objects which are already defined as things that are known by an awareness. Thus, they must be existent for the same reason. Okay, so we've covered five of the eight mutually inclusive terms. So at this point, let's pause and actually work with this material. What I know of the system of study and debate in the Tibetan monasteries is that usually the teacher will only give a short amount of material. And then they take that short amount of material and go out to the debate court and work with it. If you give too much material, it's kind of overwhelming, isn't it? It's hard to hang on to too much. So we want enough that we have some things to work with, but not so much that we forget what we've covered. Okay, so before we go into the debates that I was working with you earlier this week, I'd like to just do a little bit of review about the kinds of answers, the four main answers that the defender in a debate would give. So this is found in this primer text on page 4. And actually, I would make some corrections to this just so it's a little clearer. And we will be making some, not corrections, but changes, because we're English speakers only working with other English speakers. There are some conventions that are found in Tibetan debate that don't really pertain to us because we don't speak Tibetan. We don't put sentences together the way they do. So we can simplify things a little bit. Okay, so let's take a look. Okay, so we've already looked at syllogisms and the different parts of a syllogism. So we'll have a subject. And if we have these two things together, that's what makes the thesis, right? That should be clear in your minds. And then we have a reason. So if someone is putting forward a debate, the challenger is putting forward a debate, but they only give you a thesis, like, for instance, the subject, the definition of existence, that's our subject, cannot be posited. We don't have a reason yet, do we? We just have these two things. So what are the possible answers that a person could give when presented with just a thesis? Why? Right. Now, why in a debate does not mean, please tell me why. That's not what it's saying. Why means, I don't believe what you're saying. I don't agree. I don't accept what you're saying. That's what it's saying.
Okay? So why? And what's the other answer?
Accept.
Accept. Okay. Now, if I give a full syllogism, take the subject sound, it's impermanent because it's a product. Now, what are your possible answers?
Reason not established.
Reason not established. What else?
No pervasion.
No pervasion. What else?
I accept.
So a challenger is going to be directing the conversation. They'll be the one standing, you know, this is the person standing, clapping their hands. So they're putting forward a syllogism. Take the subject sound. We should say take sound instead of the subject. The subject sound, it is impermanent phenomena because of being a product. Okay, so that's actually a correct reason, isn't it? So we'd say, I accept. But if we had, the subject sound, it is not impermanent phenomena. Wait, let's. Because it's a non-product, let's say. Okay, then what would be the answer then?
Reason not established.
Reason not established, right. So why is that? Why would that be your answer? Because sound is not a non-product. And that's the first thing you check.
Property of the subject.
Yes, the first thing you check is the property of the subject. Is the reason a quality of the subject? Right. So if it's not, then your debate stops right there. If we have this syllogism, take sound, it's not impermanent phenomena because it's a product. Well, the reason is established, isn't it? So then we'd say, if it's a product, it's necessarily not impermanent phenomena, no pervasion with that. Okay, so these are the three reasons, or three answers that we can give if we're given a full syllogism.
So we've been practicing this a little bit here at the Abbey, and we'll just go through it. Several of the things that we know, like this simple debate form of trying to get the trying to understand the definitions and also trying to memorize them, but also bringing in some comparisons and learning some new things. So if I said the definition of existent can't be posited, you would say?
Why?
Oh, so it follows that the definition of an existent can be posited.
Exactly.
I accept. Posit that definition. Can I put you on the spot?
Yes.
The definition of an existent is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer.
So it follows that the definition of an existence is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer.
I accept.
Okay, good. So we've been through that a few times this week, and hopefully those definitions are beginning to stick in your mind. Now, just to emphasize a couple of things, it's the challenger who will say, use the term, it follows. So depending on the statement that she gives back, whether the defender, whether it's correct or not, I can use that term, oh, so it follows, as a consequence of what she has just said. So it's a consequence. It follows that the definition of existent is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. I can say that whether it's correct or if it's incorrect. If it's incorrect, I would say, oh, so it follows. Well, okay. If she had given me an erroneous definition, maybe she'd give me the definition for object of comprehension instead. That would just realize by a reliable cognizer. Okay, if she'd given me that erroneous answer when I was asking about existent, then I could say to her, so it follows that the definition of an existence is not that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. See, I'm throwing it back to her. I'm actually, although I'm the one directing the debate, actually the debate will go wherever the person answers. You see, we have to follow, I have to respond to her answers. Okay, so the defender in any debate will never be saying it follows. I think that's fair to say. So tell me this, how do the two compare, existent and established base? Mutually inclusive. Okay, so give me an example of something that's both. Let's look at the possibilities for mutually inclusive. What is something that's both an existent and an established base?
A cat.
A cat. Could be many things, right? Any existent thing. Okay? And is there something that is an existent that is not an established base?
No.
No. Is there something that's an established base that's not an existent?
No.
Is there something that's neither?
Yes.
What?
Oh, no. Hairy teeth, or the hair on the teeth, like that kind of non-existent.
Hairy teeth. Sometimes I have hairy teeth.
That's an example from a jump I sent through of like the rabbit's horns.
Yeah. Mm. A non-existent.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then how do the two compare? An existent and that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Mutually inclusive. Okay. Is there something that's both? Posit something that's both.
Subject the pot.
The subject the pot, yeah. And is there something that is an existent that is not that which is observed by a reliable cognizer?
Nope.
Nope. Is there something that is observed by a reliable cognizer that is not an existent?
Nope.
Nope. Something that is neither?
The subject, the daughter of a barren man.
When you were comparing things, you couldn't use non-existence.
You can't compare non-existence, but you can use a non-existent as an example. Like okay. In this case, it's something that's neither. Because existent is, well, it's not the largest category, is it? Selfless is the largest category of mm-hmm. existence and non-existence. So even though there is nothing that has characteristics, you know, as an instance, we can still posit a non-existent mm-hmm. as something that's neither. So the definition of established base can't be posited.
Why?
Thank you. So it follows the definition of established base can be posited.
I accept.
Posit that definition.
And the definition of an established base is that which is established by a reliable cognizer.
So it follows that the definition of established base is that which is established by a reliable cognizer.
I accept.
Okay, good. So let me ask you this. How do these two compare? Existent, and that which is established by a reliable cognizer?
Mutually inclusive.
Mutually inclusive. Okay, so this is a good point to make that because existent and established base are mutually inclusive, their definitions will be mutually inclusive. Not interchangeable necessarily, but mutually inclusive. And so each of the definiendums is mutually inclusive with the definition of the other. Does that make sense? Existent, yes.
It would lead me to want to say that there's eight definitions for existent.
There are eight definitions that are mutually inclusive with existent. There's only one definition for existent. Yeah. So existent is mutually inclusive with these seven, I want to call them synonyms, but I'm not going to. What was the word? Not synonym, but inclusive?
Equivalence.
Yeah, okay. So these seven equivalents. Existent is mutually inclusive with these seven equivalents. Existence is also mutually inclusive with its own definition, that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. You know, I'm just using these specific examples to demonstrate a larger principle here. And existent is also mutually inclusive with the definition of the seven, what was the word?
Equivalence.
Thank you. Type that in so I don't forget. So the definition of object of comprehension cannot be posited.
Why? Yeah.
Also, it follows the definition of object of comprehension can be positive.
Except.
Posit that definition, please.
Can you repeat the term, please?
Object of comprehension.
An object of comprehension uh-huh. is that which is realized by a reliable cognizer.
Right. So it follows that the definition of the object of comprehension is that which is realized by a reliable cognizer.
I accept.
Great. Okay, you all make it look so easy. So for the people who might be watching this online, this kind of exercise may seem a little bit laborious, going through it, first of all, by just reading the definition from the text, you know, that's perfectly fine to do. To begin with, we may not have the definitions memorized. But as we go through this exercise, hopefully you can find someone either in person or online to do some of this debating back and forth. Again, the reason I read that quote by Tupten Jinpa is just to remind us and also kind of settle down the mind that says, oh, I don't like rote learning. This is boring. But actually, it can be a lot of fun. There were a lot of laughing and high energy when we were working on this the other day. So in the beginning, debate has a rigid format with set formulas and fixed answers. This is a debate primer. It's filled with these kind of sample debates so that we can get familiar with the language of debate. In fact, any of you who have access to the book called Debate by Dan Perdue, there's a really nice section in there that goes through the debate on colors very slowly, very painstakingly, where he actually interjects explanation of the debate that you were mentioning the other day, page 99 to 133, I think it is. So I would encourage you to have a look at that just for some more background information about how the debate works. So now one of you can ask about object. You can ask someone in the room for the definition of object. Go ahead, you were the last person.
Venerable Jigme, the definition of an object cannot be posited.
Why?
So it follows that the definition of an object can be posited.
I accept.
Posit it.
The subject that which is known by an awareness.
So it follows that the definition of an object is that which is known by an awareness.
I accept.
Okay. And then you want to ask someone object of knowledge?
Venerable Pandey, the definition of object of knowledge cannot be posited.
Why?
It follows that the definition of object of knowledge can't be posited.
I accept.
Posited?
The definition of object is...
Of knowledge.
The definition of knowledge is that which is suitable. Mm-hmm. As an object of an awareness?
It follows that the definition of object of knowledge is that which is suitable as an object of awareness.
I accept.
Good. Excellent. Okay, let's do one more. So you can pick whichever one you like. You can ask anyone in the room, except Venerable Tarpa. She's been working on water things, all things water.
Yes, I've got it right.
Okay. You're willing. Okay.
Also, can I ask about the definition of object of comprehension?
Yeah.
Of an omniscient...
Well, we haven't really covered that in the text, so maybe stick with the first five that we've learned.
First five.
Yeah, that's enough. We haven't memorized... Well, some of us haven't memorized all those yet.
Oh, I see. So the definition of an existent cannot be deposited?
Cannot be posited. Who do you want to ask?
Verbal Losa.
Okay.
Why?
Oh, it follows that the object, the definition of the of an existent can be posited.
I accept.
Posited.
The definition of an existent is that which is observed by a reliable cognite.
So it follows that the definition of an existent is that which can be observed by a reliable cognizer.
I accept.
You guys are too good. Okay. Okay, any questions about that format? Any doubts coming up? Yeah.
One thing I really noticed when Venerable Donyo was here, because I'd known him before he was here, mm-hmm. was that from his debate practice, his memory had improved a lot, like Thupten Jinpa said, or they said in the thing you read earlier. Because when we were doing the debate with him those days, he was remembering so clearly what we said. We couldn't even remember what we said to him, but he was remembering what we said, and I don't ever remember speaking with him in that way before.
Uh-huh.
I really think it sharpened his listening abilities,
yeah.
And then remembering what we had said, it was quite impressive to me. To me, that seems like one of the hardest parts of being able to do this, because then they go back through all these things, and he would remember them.
Yes. That's why we're starting very slowly with just a few lines, and then we'll build on that in chapter 11, I think you said it was, where we actually look to see, well, what's the reason for what you're stating? Yeah.
I think having to memorize some of these things to begin with improves your memory in general. I think that's a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just people that memorize a lot of stuff, their minds get very sharp.
Yeah.
And then they have a better memory as it goes.
Yeah. Two things come to my mind. One was, I remember studying Paths and Grounds, and there were 110 definitions to memorize, and some of them were quite long and wordy. And I noticed by the end of that eight-week period that my mind was different. It was like a sponge. You know, I'd just look at something and I'd start memorizing it automatically because your mind gets conditioned in that way. Our mind is a muscle. It will do what we encourage it to do and does become conditioned in a certain way. So this will help to improve all the other things, all the other subjects, topics that we're studying. And then another example came to my mind. I had a friend from Chenrezig who ended up going to Sera, and I saw him winter of 2015 when I was there for His Holiness's teachings. And he wasn't bragging, but he was just sharing with me that if he has a really good session of memorization in the morning, and they're doing, I don't know, five or six pages, Pecha pages each morning at least, maybe more for some. He said if he had a really good session of memorization, there was a kind of clarity in his mind for the rest of the day. And I had a good kind of envy and rejoicing. Like, wow, that's amazing. It didn't inspire me to come home and start memorizing pages of definitions, but it should have. It could have. Okay, so I would encourage you to find someone to keep doing this kind of debate back and forth until you don't have to stop and really work at remembering so that they just roll off your tongue. That's the kind of memory that we're looking for. The kind of memory that even 3 months from now, you still have that definition in mind. And I mentioned to some of you what I have found in my own practice is that if I memorize something on day one, on day two, when I go back to it, often I can't remember what I've memorized. But with a little bit of prompting, you know, just a little bit of review, it comes back much more quickly than it did the first time I put it in my mind. And then by the third day, if I've gone over it a third consecutive day, then it's pretty much embedded in the mind. As long as it's not too much material, it's pretty much embedded in the mind. So you might notice in our little practice sessions, you know, the mind really has to reach for the definition, like realized by a reliable cognizer. But after a while, it will just roll off the tongue. So we've got time. Let's do a little bit more in the text. Just before we go into that, I found another really nice quote from Dan Perdue's book called Debate. He says, "More than merely asking and answering questions, debate is a process for establishing what is irrefutable or incontrovertible. What is validly established will be borne out by debate, and what is specious," I guess that's dubious, doubtful, "will be revealed and destroyed." So, you might have a doubt about something. It's not very clear in your mind, but as you go through a debate with somebody, then the boundaries of that particular term or that object become clear in your mind. As an example, right now we may not be very clear about the difference between a direct perceiver in general. You know, we did mention those. The text does mention those as one type of valid a reliable cognizer. But direct perceiver is actually a whole category of non-conceptual consciousnesses. So we might wonder, well, how do the two compare, direct perceiver and reliable cognizer? How do those two compare? Are they the same? Are they exactly the same? So this is where you'd have to know the definitions to really understand, well, how is it that they relate? Okay, so we know about reliable cognizer, that's a new incontrovertible knower. And a direct perceiver in general is a non-conceptual and non-mistaken knower. Non-conceptual and non-mistaken knower. Non-mistaken with regard to its appearing object, that's what that's referring to. Okay, so we might have a doubt about, we're really fuzzy, unclear about how those two things compare to each other. So then we start asking, okay, is there something that's both a direct perceiver and a reliable cognizer? Can you think of something?
VCU.
Yes, but, okay, you can use a particular consciousness. So your eye consciousness seeing my form, actually, isn't it? The form of my body.
Color and shape.
Color and shape.
Would it be the first moment?
Yeah, it would be necessarily be the first moment. But if we use just a name of a type of mind. So I said that there were two names for direct perceiver. Direct perceiver is actually a general category. It's always confused me why they use that as synonymous or equivalent with direct reliable cognizer. Because actually direct perceiver includes many other consciousnesses. This might be a little bit too detailed, but okay, so there, one type of direct perceiver is a direct reliable cognizer. It's a non-conceptual and non-mistaken mind. It's also a new incontrovertible knower. So that's something that's both. But is there something that is a reliable cognizer that is not a direct perceiver, not a non-conceptual mind? For example?
Inferential reliable cognizer.
Right. And is there something that is a direct perceiver that is not a reliable cognizer? Actually, there is. Is there something that is a direct perceiver? So it's non-conceptual and non-mistaken. That is not a reliable cognizer. Do you have it, Melissa? We talked about this too.
Well, it could be an eye consciousness with a faulty eye faculty, like that sees a double moon.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah,
so a faulty sense source.
We can think. Yes, that's a very good answer.
So a sense consciousness based on a faulty sense source.
Yeah. That's a good example. Maybe a more simple example is the second moment of a direct reliable cognizer.
Why is that considered unreliable?
Well, it's not new. That's the only reason. It's incontrovertible, but it's not a reliable cognizer because it doesn't fit the definition. It's not new, incontrovertible knower. Okay, and then we can think of something that's neither.
Stink bug.
Yeah.
I think the example you gave is not mistaken consciousness.
It's a wrong consciousness, but it's a non-conceptual wrong consciousness. Ah, no, it's not a direct perceiver. Wait, no, it's not a direct perceiver. That's right. It is non-conceptual, but it's mistaken. It's mistaken with regard to its appearing object, so thank you for that.
So it's not a direct perceiver.
It's not a direct perceiver. It's non-conceptual, but it's not a direct perceiver. Yeah, thank you for correcting that. Okay,
so
yeah.
Definition of a direct perceiver again?
A direct perceiver is non-conceptual and non-mistaken, but the example you gave is mistaken, isn't it, with regard to its appearing object. It's appearing to be two moons, for example, but it's one moon. Sorry, thank you for that correction.
So I just want to make sure I have this right. So direct perceiver is sometimes used as the main category,
mm-hmm.
and it's sometimes used as a direct reliable cognizer.
Right.
But are there direct perceivers that are not direct reliable cognizers?
Yes, like for instance, the second moment of a direct perceiver.
Okay.
It's a subsequent cognizer, isn't it?
Okay, and then my other question is, how about the one that is appearing but not ascertained?
That's also, that comes in the category of direct perceiver. Okay, sorry, that's probably gotten a little more into Loewig than I intended, but why were we talking about this? Oh, because this is why how debate and looking at comparisons and doing this kind of questioning can help us to really get clear about what's included in each category. In fact, to answer the questions of comparisons, you have to know, you have to at least have a good guess of what's in that category so that you can pick something that's in one that's not the other and vice versa, or something that's both. Okay, so maybe we'll be able to finish these eight today.
All right, so here at the bottom of page 145, and for those with ebooks, it starts with, next, Buddhists say that everything that exists. So next, Buddhists say that everything that exists is an object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness, which is defined as an object realized by an omniscient consciousness. Here the requirements are that an existent must be an object and must be realized. Okay, an object realized by an omniscient consciousness. So here the requirements are that an existent must be an object, in other words, it must exist, and it must be realized. Realized means realized by a reliable cognizer, a new incontrovertible knower. So we're sort of mixing topics here. I know we're not studying mind and awareness, but it's important that we know something about mind and awareness to understand these definitions. That's why I've brought it in. Okay, so realized means realized by a reliable cognizer. So that alone limits the object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness to actual existence. Anyway, it would be ridiculous to think that an omniscient consciousness would know something non-existent. Obviously, the more important point here is the assertion that there are omniscient consciousnesses. The Buddha is said to be omniscient or all-knowing. Now, okay, some of you have studied tenets as well. You remember that the two lower schools assert that the Buddha is all-knowing. Do you remember what that means? How that's different from omniscient? So we can compare. How do the two compare?
Yeah. Well, they're mutually... I think they're mutually exclusive. Did you want me to give a definition or explain what they are?
Explain what all-knowing means.
Okay, all-knowing means that you can a mind that can know anything, but it has to turn its mind towards that object, where omniscience is to know everything at once without having to turn one's mind towards that object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. In the description of all-knowing, it says, a Buddha knows objects one by one by thinking of them. Now, when I hear the word thinking, I assume it's a conceptual mind. I'm not sure if that's what's intended, but that's what stands out to me. Whereas we know that all consciousnesses of a Buddha are non-conceptual. Technically, a Buddha doesn't think because a Buddha knows everything all at once, so there's no conceptual thoughts necessary.
That's when Jeffrey says that the word thought is used kind of broadly sometimes, okay. And I think it's better for us to say cognized, because that the word cognized, like you said, all-knowing is knowing objects one by one when cognizing about them. It, then we don't run into that problem, because cognize is more... doesn't necessarily turn the mind to a generic image, whereas thought for us does, although Jeffrey's saying thought can be used more broadly.
Right. Thought and conceptuality can be used very broadly in a sense of including all minds, or it can be narrowly used to mean minds that engage an object through a generic image or a mental image. A Buddha is said to be omniscient or all-knowing. A Buddha is also said to be omnibenevolent or all-loving, and sometimes said to be omnipresent or present everywhere. However, Buddhists do not assert that a Buddha is omnipotent or all-powerful. It is quite a claim that anyone could be omniscient, and all Buddhists think that the Buddha is omniscient. Moreover, the Tibetans generally agree that it is within the capacity of each and every one of us to become omniscient, as the Buddha did. Okay, so obviously he's not teaching tenets here, right? Because not all tenet schools assert that. Do you remember which tenet schools assert one final vehicle? Definitely Prasangika.
Mm-hmm. Mindoni school and the... middle way schools.
Both middle way schools do, and some of the mind only practitioners do. Okay. Not all.
Following scripture, which one is it?
Following scripture don't, or sometimes it's stated false aspectarians don't. Yeah, because those two terms are not equivalent. But
and all Buddhists don't say that the Buddha is omniscient. Some say that he's all-knowing.
Yes, the two lower schools. So Great Exposition School and Sutra School say that he is all-knowing. The three higher schools, middle way schools, and mine only say that.
I think currently some of the Theravadins adhere to that, but I'm not sure.
That he's all-knowing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
These are the kind of interesting conversations that we can have with our Theravadan friends, you know, in a gentle, playful way. Not like, do you think? What does your school say?
This is the lower school.
Yeah, we wouldn't use those terms, would we? Okay. All right. What's more, they generally, so all Buddhists, moreover, the Tibetans generally agree that is within the capacity of each and every one of us to become omniscient, as the Buddha did. What's more, they generally agree that in time we will all do so. Your omniscient exists now. What would you say? Oh, wait. No. Let me back up. Your omniscience exists.
How come I don't know about it?
Your omniscient exists. It just doesn't exist now. But they say it does exist because the potential for it exists.
It's like wordplay.
Yeah.
Future.
A lot of debate is wordplay. In fact, the Tibetans love wordplay. And unfortunately, some of these wordplays are lost when they're translated into English. But we can make up our own.
Wouldn't that be saying like the future exists in the present?
Tomorrow exists. It just doesn't exist now.
Not really.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to answer that. Okay. Sometimes when I can't figure something out, I think that in time I will know. But from my present perspective, this is just an article of faith and may not turn out to be so. Just on its own, though, the very idea that anyone who is a normal person trying to deal with life, as the Buddha was, could become omniscient is a startling assertion. Really, it's true, isn't it? But that is the system. In fact, that is the goal. Recall that Lati Rinpoche said, there is no phenomena that cannot be understood. There is no doctrine that, if studied well, cannot be learned. And there is no person who, if he or she studies well, cannot become wise. That's a good reminder. That was from earlier in the text. Okay, so now we're up to the seventh equivalent. Next, every existence is a hidden phenomena. And hidden phenomena is defined as an object realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it. Okay, so this is getting into a little bit of interesting territory. The heart of this definition is that each and every existent is realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it. It is an existent object, and if it is understood by a thought consciousness, it must be understood in a hidden manner. The point here is about how thought works. That is, thought, conceptuality, a thinking consciousness, a conception of anything, here limited to the existent, understands that thing by a hidden technique, in a representative way by the appearance of an internal image of whatever you are understanding. Okay, so in a nutshell, what that's saying is that there are any existent phenomena, any existent object can become an object of thought consciousness or conceptual mind. We can call any object to mind. So we can have a perceptual realization of the shape and color of this thing we call cup. But if I put it away and ask you to think about the cup, you can call an image to mind. So everything can become an object of a conceptual mind. There are certain things that can only be known by a conceptual mind. In this school of thought, permanent phenomena can only be known explicitly by a conceptual. Wait, let me take that back.
Fully realized.
I just read this, so I hope I can say it. In the Sutra school, permanent phenomena, which are generally characterized phenomena, are known to conceptual minds fully. A conceptual mind can never fully know a impermanent, specifically characterized phenomena in this system.
So you would say, or this is saying, that a permanent thing can be fully known. It can't be known in a more full way.
Yeah.
Because it's never an object of a direct perception.
The direct perceivers fully know the impermanent or specifically characterized phenomena. Mm-hmm. The conceptual thought can know them, but it can't fully know them in the same way. Just like when you see that gong,
yeah,
when you see it with your eye consciousness, all of its particular parts, all the details are there. But when you think about it, it's more fuzzy. That's how Venerable did it with us once, in like an experiment. Like, what works well for me on this is you ring the gong and you hear it, and then you think about the sound of it. Mm-hmm. So she taught us this that way, and that was helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, more to come on that, because there's a lot of detail there. Yeah, please.
So are all hidden phenomena existent? It's saying here that they are mutually inclusive?
Okay. Well, it's equivalent with existent. Yeah.
Oh, so, I mean, but that doesn't mean that anything that you can think of is existent, right? A misunderstanding.
No. Okay. No. No, what I'm saying is that any existent thing can be taken as an object, can be taken to mind by a conceptual consciousness. But, as you're saying, even non-existent things can be taken to mind by a conceptual consciousness.
And are non-existent things hidden phenomena then?
They're not phenomena at all.
Oh, right. Okay, that's right.
But your thought of them is an existent phenomena.
Yes.
The definition starts as an object, so that limits it to existence.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
and realized.
On page 165, There's a division of existence in the hidden phenomena and manifest phenomena. So we'll get to some more on this.
Yeah. Yeah. My memory is that manifest phenomena are those things that are known by direct perceivers. And hidden phenomena pervade manifest phenomena. In other words, all manifest phenomena can be known by a conceptual mind, but there are other things that are non-manifest that can be known by a conceptual mind. Okay, so how do the two compare? Hidden phenomena and manifest... Oh. No, let's not do that. Okay. I'll come back with that one. I have to think about that one some more. Yeah, next week. Thank you. Okay, let's see, where did we end? The point here is about how thought works. That is, thought, conceptuality, thinking, consciousness, a conception of anything, here limited to the existent, understands that thing by a hidden technique in a representative way by the appearance of an internal image of whatever you are understanding. According to the explanation of conceptuality in this system, when we think of things we know, we proceed by observing an internal mental image of the thing, and that internal mental image stands in place of or represents what we are understanding. You can kind of catch yourself doing this when you think of something you learned very early on, like dog or cat or ice cream. Those internal images seem strong and vivid. Just two more points here. Oh, that reminds me, didn't Jeffrey say something about when you recall a generic image to mind, like ice cream, you're just getting at a very general thing. You're not thinking chocolate chip mint, or maybe you're not even thinking of it being cold. You're not thinking of all its characteristics. You're getting at a very general, not a full understanding of what that thing is. Very different as opposed to putting a bite of ice cream in your mouth.
I see chocolate chip ice cream when I think of ice cream.
Well, that's because you're special.
No.
Okay.
How curious it is that we all have a very specific flavor of ice cream to ourselves that somehow stands in for all ice creams. Mm-hmm. Then we were like, yeah, that's true. So weird. I think that's how our conceptual images work, right? I think we all have a specific flavor, I would think, or color that just appears like that.
Mm-hmm. So if I say dog, probably each of us would have a unique type of dog. Probably the first dog we had, or the type of first dog we had, or our favorite dog. Or did you have something else? Okay. Those internal images seem strong and vivid. Just two more points here. Buddhists say that such an internal image is static and permanent. And though they do affirm certain thoughts as valid and reliable, they find the avenue of reliance on internal images to be somewhat less preferred than the avenue of understanding an existent directly. So a person can realize emptiness through the medium of a generic image and even develop an inferential cognition of emptiness. Wouldn't that be amazing? I would take that mind, even though it's second rate to a direct perceiver, direct reliable cognizer. But still, it would not be the same, even though the only thing appearing to your mind is emptiness with a inferential reliable cognizer. Still, it's very different than the water being poured into water explanation of a direct perception, direct reliable cognizer. There is more on this coming later, as Venerable Losong pointed out. Manifest and non-manifest, also more about minds. Just remember here that Buddhism is a meditative tradition, not just a system of reasoning and debate. So they emphasize the priority and superiority of direct perception over thought, especially the Sutra school. Okay, the eighth and last equivalent here is that every existent is a phenomena defined as that which holds its own entity. This is entirely different from the other definitions, for it emphasizes the character of the thing itself, not the consciousness perceiving it. It affirms self-identity, that a thing is identical with itself, and in its own way, understood variously by different Buddhist tenet systems, it affirms the world. Okay, so these are eight characterizations of what exists. There are more, such as basis and common locus, not explained here. There is a table in the appendix that gives all the definienda and definitions together. Each of these eight compare to the selfless as 3P without something that is neither. We talked about that last week. They are all mutually inclusive with each other, with each of the others, with both the definitions and the definienda. Within the restrictions mentioned above, that excludes objects of knowledge of which being them is not possible. They are 3-possibility, or 3P, with any particular impermanent phenomena. Practically, anything may be provided as illustrations or examples here, because anything from a pot to a pillar to a post to a person is an existent. Just use what is at hand, even your hand. These are 4P, with many permanent phenomena, such as definition. Okay, so that is 3P, with any particular impermanent phenomena. Okay, so as I understand it, he's talking about existent and impermanent phenomena, right? Comparing the two. How do the two compare? Okay. I think it works both ways, but okay, let's use a particular impermanent phenomena. So existent and cup, let's say. How do those two compare? Yeah, 3 possibilities. So something that's both? The cup on my table. What is a cup that's not an existent? Doesn't exist. What is an existent that's not a cup? The book I'm holding. And something that's neither? Horns of a rabbit. There you go. Okay. Now, these eight are 4P with many permanent phenomena such as definition. Let's use something we're more familiar with, like emptiness. Okay. So existent and emptiness. What's something that's both? Emptiness and existent.
Emptiness. Yeah. The emptiness of the cup.
The emptiness of the cup. There you go. And something that is emptiness that is not an existent. These eight are 4P with many permanent phenomena such as definition.
Emptiness of our rabbit horns?
That's my guess. The emptiness of a rabbit horn. A rabbit's horns. Yeah. And then something that is an existent that is not emptiness. My computer. Yeah, anything really. Any existent thing, right? That's not emptiness. And then something that's neither an existent or an emptiness. Sky flower. There you go. Okay. You're falling asleep, so let's just end with a couple of back and forths with these 3 definitions that we just learned. Okay? Who'd like to start? Venerable Damcha.
Let's pick Venerable Nima. The definition of a hidden phenomenon cannot be posited.
Why?
It follows that the definition of a hidden phenomenon can be posited.
I accept.
Posited.
Hidden phenomena is an object realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it.
It follows that the definition of a hidden phenomenon is an object realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it.
I accept.
So how many times do you think you'd have to go back and forth for that to really stick? A few? Okay. So now you ask somebody the same question.
Venerable Lamsa, it follows that the definition...
Follow yet. She hasn't said anything.
Thank you. Okay. The definition of a phenomenon cannot be posited.
Why?
Oh, so it follows that it can be posited.
Except.
Posited.
The definition of a phenomena is that which holds its own entity.
So it follows that the definition of a phenomenon is that which holds its own entity.
I accept. And Rupema, the definition of the definition of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness cannot be posited.
Why?
So it follows that the definition of an object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness can be posited.
I accept.
Posited.
The definition of an object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness is an object realized by omniscient consciousness.
So it follows that the definition of an object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness is an object realized by omniscient consciousness.
I accept. One more? You want to ask somebody? Hey, Renato. Okay, well, let's just do one more. Ask Renato. You can ask, Venerable. You can be the challenger, if you like.
The definition of a phenomenon cannot be posited.
Why?
It follows that the definition of phenomenon can be posited.
I accept.
Posited.
The definition of a phenomenon is that which holds its own entity.
You
can say it follows, yeah.
Okay, it follows that the definition of a phenomenon is that which holds its own entity.
I accept.
Great. Okay, so we finished at the bottom of page 147. Next week we'll start with seven divisions of existence. So my hope is that you'll work with this week and really have these under your belt. We don't have tests in this class, so it benefits you if you learn it. If you don't learn it, it doesn't benefit you as much. So, okay, we'll finish there. For next week, let's see. Probably we'll cover all of permanent phenomena. So up to page 156, the bottom of 156, if you want to read ahead. So let's take a moment to rejoice that we've had this time to learn a little bit more about debate, the functioning of debate, sharpening our minds, increasing our wisdom.